Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Washington DC is still digesting the news that a senior Trump cabinet member accidentally added a journalist to a messaging group sharing sensitive military details about forthcoming airstrikes. Democrats describe the leak as an embarrassment, sloppy, careless, incompetent behaviour, but President Trump downplayed it as the only glitch in 2 months, insisting it turned out not to be a serious one. Well, in a moment we're going to consider how the Democrats are handling the Trump presidency more broadly, but let's get the latest now. We're joined by Chief Correspondent with Feature Story News, Simon Mark. So, Simon, we see President Trump was very keen to downplay this, but what are other Republicans and military commentators saying about the leak?
Well, look, there is absolute astonishment here in Washington, Claire, that this could possibly have happened, because while the Signal messaging app is encrypted, it is certainly not the place that senior national security and defence officials should be gathering in order to share details of the war plan that they had at the time to launch military strikes against Iran-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen. So the Republican focus now is very much on what lawmakers on Capitol Hill here are going to do. Are any of them going to break cover with the White House and join Democrats who are now calling for the resignation at least of Pete Hegseth, the US Defense Secretary, and possibly seeking other heads to roll, including the National Security Advisor Mike Waltz, who appears to be the man who first connected with Jeffrey Goldberg, the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, over Signal. Whether he is the man who added Jeffrey Goldberg inadvertently to the chat is unclear. Mike Waltz last night seemed to suggest that it might have been a lower level member of his staff. But at the moment, the real furore is being created by the Democrats and not by the Republicans, who really bent over backwards during a Senate Intelligence Committee hearing yesterday to provide support and succor to the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, the CIA Director, John Ratcliffe, and Kash Patel, the Director of the FBI, who were among those officials testifying. As far as the military community is concerned, there is just jaw-dropping disbelief that this could possibly have happened.
Yeah, I saw one of Obama's former staffers speaking last night, a man called Pfeiffer, who was involved in designing some of the security systems that are currently and still in place, for people like Pete Hegseth, expressing absolute disbelief that despite the fact that they have all of these equipment, the safe room, safe cars, safe telephones, even if they're staying in a hotel, they have systems available to them for secure communications, that this Signal app was used. But are you telling us now that the focus really is on the Republicans and whether any of them will break ranks here?
Well, I think it has to be, because it is clear that President Trump is circling the wagons and wants to move on and wants to avoid any sense that in circling the wagons, he might be creating a circular firing squad within his administration. So it was pretty evident yesterday that the CIA director, John Ratcliffe, during testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee, was forced into a corner where he started pointing the finger of blame at Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. I mean, it became clear by the end of the hearing that Hegseth had shared war plans, as they described them. Almost certainly classified information in that chat room, as Jeffrey Goldberg maintains. But the CIA director's position was that because he's the defense secretary, Pete Hegseth has the power instantly to declassify information. So perhaps he declassified the information just seconds before he pasted it into the chat room. Now, President Trump is calling all of this a glitch. He says Mike Waltz, the National Security Advisor, has learnt his lesson. Mm-hmm. He wants to move on from this. If the Republicans in Congress, who so far have been largely supine before President Trump, continue to adopt a supine position, then the Democrats have very limited powers to mount investigations or advance this in any meaningful way. And it's possible this will just get brushed under the carpet in large measure.
And Simon, the journalist involved, Jeffrey Goldberg, he went out of his way to say, look, there are certain things that I saw in this chat room that I'm not going to publish because I don't want to put lives at risk. But it seemed as time went on yesterday and they were continuing to attack him and attack the Atlantic where he works, that he was going to try, or he was certainly working on trying to find a way to publish more. Do you think we'll get more information from the Atlantic on this story?
Yeah, I'm sure we will. I mean, look, at the moment, Jeffrey Goldberg is the adult in the chat room because he's the man who says, I think I saw classified information. I'm redacting that. I'm not putting it into the public domain. Well, yesterday, the president of the United States, Donald Trump, said there was nothing in that chat room that was classified information. Goldberg could now argue, and his lawyers may advise, that Donald Trump essentially yesterday declassified everything that appeared in that chat room, and therefore the way may be clear for Jeffrey Goldberg, without fear of consequences, to publish what he saw. Now, he's made it very clear that he's also acting out of patriotic duty. He doesn't want to reveal sources who whose names may be included in that chat room conversation and who may find themselves on the receiving end of repercussions for some of the content of that chat room talk. So he's got a difficult decision to make, because at the moment you've got Republicans all insisting there was no classified information therein, Goldberg saying there definitely was. So the ball's really back in his court now to decide just how much of that information he's willing to share with the public.
Yep, and how safely he can do that. Now, I just want to ask you briefly as well about J.D. Vance, the vice president, who has decided that he's going to go to Greenland with this high-level delegation. Greenland and Denmark both say that this is aggressive, so I'm not sure he's going to be welcome when he lands there. How's it being viewed in Washington?
Well, I think that the attention here has been so focused on the signal scandal that it hasn't received as much attention here as it is receiving in Europe. But certainly we were aware that the second lady was planning to make this trip to Greenland, which raised some eyebrows. She would have become the latest in a series of White House-related officials, including Donald Trump Jr., to set foot in Greenland and try and encourage people there to go along with this idea that Greenland must become an American territory. The fact that J.D. Vance is going, the man who is a heartbeat away from President Donald Trump, again underscores the fact that Donald Trump is determined that the United States is going to take control of Greenland. This is not a laughable, you know, notion that people were scoffing about several months ago when it was first raised. This is a real ambition for America's president. He wants to expand America's territory, take control of the Panama Canal, plant the Stars and Stripes in the Gaza Strip, and so on. And Greenland is central to those aims because he says America needs it for national security protection. So to put J.D. Vance's boots on that ground, uninvited by the Danish or Greenland authorities, is definitely upping the ante.
All right, but JD has to prove loyalty to President Trump again now because of some of the things he said in that Signal chat, but that's for another day. Simon, thank you so much. Simon Marks there from Feature Story News. Now, I said we also wanted to look this morning at how Democrats are scrambling or not to oppose President Trump, and I'm joined now by National Affairs correspondent with The Nation, John Nichols, who has co-authored a book with Bernie Sanders called It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. John, it's great to have you with us this morning. Let's start with, you know, where the Democrats are at. And we got a sense of that with this Signal scandal from Simon Marks there, because it can be difficult to know where to begin. Is that the Democrats' problem, that they're sort of spinning in Donald Trump's wind?
Well, it's good to be with you. And absolutely, that is the problem. They have, not just since Trump was sworn in, but really since the election, been playing catch up. Trump does something, someone else in Trump's administration does something, there's controversy, the Democrats rush to express their concern, their opposition, their shock. And the trouble is that they do not seem to be setting any kind of agenda, any kind of North Pole. And that's a big issue in a moment like this. What you see in the polling is that a growing number of Americans are very upset with Donald Trump, and especially with Elon Musk, Donald Trump's sidekick. But at the same time, they're not particularly happy with the Democrats either. Mm-hmm. So the Democrats aren't getting the usual bounce that you would in a situation like this.
He's still polling at around 50% approval ratings, though, isn't he? Mm-hmm. Which can't be too bad if you're in Donald Trump's camp.
Well, it isn't that bad. Although if you go into the polling, it starts to look pretty dark. Mm-hmm. He historically had very high ratings for his management of the economy. Whether you like him or not, there was a sense that he could do that. With the instability in the stock market and a lot of other issues, he's losing numbers very rapidly. And again, I think if you look at the polling, the thing to do is look at those numbers for Elon Musk, because Musk has in many ways become the face of the administration in the United States. And Musk's numbers have collapsed. He's now in much polling, you'll see only about a third of people approve of who he is and what he's doing.
And do you see, John, that the Democrats have learned anything from the presidential election, where Kamala Harris went out on this line that, you know, Donald Trump was going to be a threat to democracy, and still voters in every swing state elected him anyway? Have they learned from that off-key campaign?
Some Democrats have and some have not. Look, just look at the news of today. You have the whole Signal scandal, the controversy, and that does pose a threat. And so Democrats are talking about it. They are responding to it. That's appropriate. At the same time, the real lesson of the 2024 election was that Democrats didn't talk enough about the economy. They didn't have a clearly focused economic message. And as they chase after the latest scandal, the Trump administration, they're still struggling in many senses to deliver an alternative economic message. Some Democrats are doing that. Chris Murphy, Bernie Sanders, a few others. But at core, it's clear from the polling that the average American doesn't see the Democratic Party as having a particularly clear alternative to Trump on those core economic issues.
And can the Democrats win back those working class blue collar voters who felt, it would seem from the election results, certainly forgotten or abandoned by the party?
Yes, they can. And it will probably come with a focus on a particular issue that is of deep concern, especially to middle-aged and older swing voters and working class voters. And that's the impact of the Trump administration on Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Basically, those are our core social welfare programs in the United States. There's already a pretty clear set of evidence that suggests that Musk and the Republicans want to go after Medicaid, to take money out of Medicaid. They've also suggested that there's a lot of fraud in Social Security. They are radically transforming how Social Security operates, even shutting down phone lines where people could call in and express concerns about their payments, things like that. And so that's an area that is very perilous for the Republicans, and one that if the Democrats deliver a strong message, I think they really can gain ground. I was at a town meeting the other day in a small town in a district that voted for Trump, and a Democratic congressman was there, and he was taking testimony from people. You know, what are you concerned about? Person after person came up, older, yes, but even some younger folks talking about Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security.
Mm-hmm. Interesting to hear that. But in the short term, you've got Donald Trump ruling through executive order, also using, as you've mentioned, the unelected Elon Musk to ram through some of these changes. So that makes it very difficult for the Democrats to do anything about it, certainly in the short to medium term. Do you agree?
Absolutely. The only thing they can do is hope that the controversy over some of these issues might cause individual Republicans to break with their caucus. They have not yet at a level that matters. A couple did in the Senate on some appointments, but by and large not. This is the key. The Republican control of the House and the Senate is very, very narrow. Just a handful of seats. If in the House you were to get three of the 435 members, three Republican members, to come over and vote with the Democrats on a particular issue, perhaps one of these economic issues, the Democrats would be able to stop Trump. And that's really the focus of, I think, the savvier Democrats at this point. They are going to Republican districts. They are rallying people, trying to get sort of a grassroots appeal for some of those Republicans to break. If that doesn't happen, if Trump and Musk, with his money, can maintain a kind of firewall, a universal United Republican caucus in the House and the Senate, then the Democrats really only have their opposition voice. They can object, but they can't really stop.
And John, let's look ahead then to 2028. Are we looking at an election between J.D. Vance and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez?
No.
Why?
Well, look, both of them might be candidates. I mean, Vance will run, undoubtedly. But Vance has been very marginalized within the administration. Remember, they've got all these things going on. He's been sent to Greenland. I understand that Greenland is a big deal for Trump. It is not a big deal for Americans. And so Vance has had a very rough first few months in this administration, very much in the shadow of Elon Musk. There are many other ambitious Republicans, so you can't assume that he will be the easy or natural successor. Trump has a history of being very rough with his vice presidents and very dismissive of them. On the Democratic side, AOC is unquestionably getting a lot of great response. She was out with Sanders on his anti-oligarchy tour. They were drawing tens of thousands of people. There's no question she is very, very popular. But she is also very savvy. She is a young woman who has proven that she isn't in a rush. She is willing to take her time, get, you know, into a place where I think she's going to be a long-term political leader in the United States. It is possible that she could run in 2028, but it is also possible that she could wait 4 years or even 8 years. She has that time. And my sense is that there are going to be many other Democrats who are running. Mm-hmm. Doesn't exclude AOC, but it does suggest that that's going to be a very, very crowded Democratic field in 2020.
So it may not be her time. John, a great pleasure to talk to you. John Nichols there, who's National Affairs Correspondent with The Nation.